It is 10:59, and coming up next is The Food Show. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support. To stay informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Pueblo Unido PDX 1-year anniversary on May 19th from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Join Portlanders in celebrating the recent success and helping community members win their cases against deportation and get out of immigration detentions. This event will feature a reception with the silent auction, raffle, light refreshments, and more. Again, that's the Pueblo Unido PDX 1-year anniversary on May 19th from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Posies on Saturday, May 19th, 9 o'clock at the Doug Fir in Portland. The Posies began its career exactly 30 years ago by releasing a home-recorded cassette called Failure. This celebratory show and tour feature the opening band, Tara Lightfoot. Again, that's the Posies on Saturday, May 19th at 9 o'clock at the Doug Fir at 830 East Burnside Street in Portland. This is a 21 and over show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to The Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. Near the end of the program, I'll have a rebroadcast of an interview I did with Eric Tonesmeyer. Eric wrote the book, The Carbon Farming Solution, a global toolkit of perennial crops and regenerative agriculture practices for climate change mitigation and food security. I'll also be talking with Marisha Auerbach for a monthly garden segment. After a hot weekend and a lot of sun on the horizon, the speed that plants are growing in the garden is picking up. Marisha is here to help us stay on top of the rapidly growing list of garden tasks. But first, the place where I connect the most with food is in my kitchen. It's there where I play with my food, where I practice cooking, where I get to be creative and nourished. In the kitchen, you get to see the transformation from ingredients to food. Since writing her book, How to Eat, nearly 20 years ago, Nigella Lawson has been the champion of the home cook. Over the years, she's written several cookbooks and appeared on TV. She shares her values of creating connections by cooking simple, flavorful meals. Most recently, she has written the cookbook, At My Table, a celebration of home cooking. Nigella, thank you so much for joining me on The Food Show.
My pleasure.
So, I recently read an essay you wrote called Home Cooking Can Be a Feminist Act. In it, you say you have to correct people who call you a chef. You tell mm-hmm. them you're actually a home cook. But why is that?
What do you mean, why is that?
Why do you feel that you need to correct folks when they call you a chef?
Because I'm not a chef. I mean, I'm not a chef. A chef is a very distinct entity. I mean, I've never cooked in a public sphere in my life. I have no training, which doesn't necessarily mean you can't be a chef. There are many chefs in restaurants who are self-taught and who have learned by apprenticeship. But I've never worked in a restaurant. I don't cook for strangers. You know, I just cook for my friends and family. I suppose what I do for my living is write about food, and sometimes I go on TV and cook food, but I'm certainly, my cooking is entirely a private matter when it actually happens as cooking. It's not... it's not something I do for a living. I'm not a professional cook.
Well, you also talk in that article about how people, when they say what they are, you know, they'll say they're just a home cook.
Yes.
And you have a problem with the word just. Can you explain that?
I feel that it's a pity. You know, I feel that the thing is that I don't for one instance feel that I have the skills and dexterity and virtuosity of a highly trained chef, but I don't think that means that I feel that the food I cook isn't good, or that it doesn't tell the story of sort of who we are. And I think that food cooked at home is very much about who we are in terms of family, cultures, experience. And I think it's a real story, and it's a story that deserves to be told. So I don't think it has to be apologized for. I think that, in a sense, it's very important, whatever you do, to be open about what it is. I would never want people to think I was making claims for myself that weren't accurate, like, for example, being a chef or having that sort of expertise. And in the same way that I sometimes get irritated when chefs write books purporting to be about home cooking, when they seem to me to be very, very distinct from that and much more about fads and technique. And I think that perhaps that is what separates often the chef from their home cook, is that, you know, I think a chef often has to be technique led, and I think I'm much more taste driven, and home cooks are. And that's not to say you can't be a talented home cook, but I think it's quite important to make the distinction, you know, because there's something to me about a chef which is perhaps there's less emotional content. If you say to me chef, and when I think of the sort of food that a chef and the chef's kitchen comes up with, to me it's slightly stripped of emotional resonance, and I think it's that emotional resonance which means something to me, and to all of us, I hasten to add.
Well, and you talk in the article about the difference between the chef's kitchen and the home kitchen, and the phrase you used that I loved, you described the home kitchen as gloriously anarchic. So what is it about the chaos of the home kitchen that you find so glorious?
Well, I mean, I hope not too much chaos. But what I feel is that in order for a restaurant kitchen to run well, it has to be really, it has to adhere to certain rules and not slip. It can't afford the slippage in terms of time. You've got many tables of people waiting for their food, and they don't want to have to wait too long. Plus, because you are feeding people that you don't know, and they're strangers, you're a stranger cooking, you know, the hygiene rules have to be incredibly strictly policed, and this is quite right. And in a way, when people go to a restaurant, they go there thinking, I know that dish, and I want it, and I want it to be the same, whereas we at home don't have to conform to that. So, for example, when I cook at home, I don't tie my hair up, and I always say to people, look, I spent my childhood eating my mother's hair, and I don't see why my children can't do the same with mine. Now, I mean that slightly facetiously, but the point is that that would be disgusting in a restaurant, whereas at home it's kind of I'm not going to lose sleep over it, and I'm not going to wear my hair in a hairnet, and that sort of thing. So I feel that, and at home, when I cook something, I kind of go with it. What have I got there? How do I feel like cooking it today? And so that means, in a way, it feels to me very creative. Whereas in many restaurants, even though the initial idea for a recipe or how the chef might have come up with a recipe may have been creative, but then it sort of consolidates into, you know, a bit of a factory. It has to be the same, and this is what people want. And for me, that's very stifling.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, they have to have that consistency because they're serving people over and over. Whereas the home cook, they're going to make a recipe once in a blue moon, you know? So, yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Well,
that...
no, but even if you cook that recipe, I mean, for example, take a roast chicken. Now, all home cooks, or most home cooks, cook, you know, roast a chicken often. Now, that you might have different herbs that you want to season it with, or you've got there. Some days you want to do it with butter, other times with oil. You might want to put some garlic cloves in. You might at other times decide to put some leeks around it. You might want to marinate it. You might decide to add a different sort of sauce afterwards. You're still just roasting a chicken, and it's still what your family might know as just your roast chicken, but it's going to alter all the time. And I like that. And it will alter because of what you've got or what maybe you've seen at the shops or in all sorts of ways. I think home cooking is very reactive, if I suppose I'd use that word. It's not a particularly nice word, but it is, that you don't do too much deciding ahead of time, I think.
So I want to kind of go back in time, and this is a question I imagine you've received a number of times and for over the years, but what inspired you to first write How to Eat nearly 20 years ago?
Yes, well, my first husband was very convinced I should write about food because I was always talking about what I thought, how I thought food should be, and I thought this was an utter nonsense, and I didn't understand why he thought that. And then I started thinking about it, and I felt that it was interesting. I was interested. There were various things that propelled me towards this. One was that I'd gone out to dinner and to someone's house, and we all sat around a table getting more and more sort of awkward as we heard her sobbing loudly in the kitchen because she's obviously had set herself this stressful menu, far too elaborate, not at all suitable for cooking at home because she wanted it to be, she'd been impressed by chefs and what they do. And I thought, really, people have got the wrong idea if they think that's what you go to someone's home to eat or that it's expected of you. So I wanted to write about home cooking. I felt it hadn't been adequately represented, it had in the past, but it was very much then a time that was dominated by the professional arena. And so that made me interested. I also was interested in language, and I didn't know, I quite wanted to see whether I could use language, which is in itself abstract, to conjure up a world which is entirely, belongs to the senses. And I suppose the other two reasons were a slightly less positive, I suppose, wanting to do it. So as well as wanting to champion home food and being interested in writing, my mother and one of my sisters died young, and I really felt this importance to write about their food. It seemed so important, this connection. And then in the course of that, actually, my husband John was diagnosed with cancer, and it was an oral cancer. He died of it. But what it really showed me how important food and sitting and eating is, because of course he couldn't eat after a while, and it's so elemental to our sense of self. So it was a really odd thing because I was talking about the importance of food, while really living through a period when I was seeing how cruel it was when you couldn't take part in that, and how it's so much part of who we are, that, and eating is a very essential part of socializing, actually. So all these things made me write the book and informed the book it was, and I suppose that's what living does to you. You have to find a way, it finds a way out somehow, and for reasons that surprise me, the way those thoughts, feelings, and reactions took form and shape was in that book of mine, How to Eat.
Well, yeah, you talk about the importance of food and how it connects to our memory and culture, and it seems like it connects to some of the hardship that you had in that time of your life. I'm just curious.
And good memories too.
And I mean, great memories.
In a sense, writing about food, you're writing about memory as well.
So I'm curious how you think that food can bring us together, especially in a time when it seems that people are so disconnected from one another politically, socially, and culturally.
Yes, well, that's a very big question, and I don't know how it is, because it is possible to eat people's food while actually not really feeling any sense of kinship with them in an important way. And so sometimes it's very important not to show, I think it's very important not to think, oh, because we eat foods from various cultures, it means that somehow it's this in itself is a good thing, and it can be a very good thing, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. But I do think this is where I think home cooking makes more of a difference, because I think you can eat foods of different cultures in restaurants, and it is just, in a sense, it's you're paying for it, and it's an experience that can be quite superficial. Not always. I think it can be profound, and it is if you're traveling. But if you get interested in a food of a particular culture, and you really look into it, and you eat in other people's homes, and you try cooking the food in your own home, I think then it has permeated to some deeper level. I do think that sitting down and eating with people is very important, and I think it's been important throughout history, but it provides a link, but I don't think it can't solve problems. And as we know, that, you know, it's important in families, but, you know, a lot of family rows happen around a table as well, and it's quite important not to idealize everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's the food is nuanced. It's not just this, like, joyful thing. It represents a lot of our life.
Indeed.
I want to talk about your new cookbook, At My Table, A Celebration of Home Cooking. So in At My Table, you say the recipes don't require technique, dexterity, or expertise. So what is the kind of person you imagine is going to use these recipes?
Well, I suppose I imagine it's people who enjoy a certain playfulness in cooking, who are willing sometimes to try things that at first they might think, oh, I'm not, oh, that sounds odd. Do I really add a poached egg to some garlicky yogurt? Well, okay, maybe I do. I mean, I think that I have a relationship, you know, this is my 11th book, I have a relationship with a lot of my readers, and so I feel they trust me, and that's important to me. But I think that, for me, it's really important that I think that if you write honestly about the food you love, and it's quite simple to make, that it's going to be, this is going to be recipes that if you've never really cooked, you know that will work. And at the same time, if you've cooked day in, day out for 20 years, will maybe just spark a bit of enthusiasm when you're worried you're getting bored. So I think, I like to think that there isn't a particular person, but that my recipes sort of speak to a lot of different people at different stages in their life, and, you know, with access to different ingredients. I mean, that's the hard thing. It's the ingredients often, because, you know, I come from a big cosmopolitan city, and I'm used to coming across all different spices and vegetables and whatever I might want. And you have to be quite precise. I can only write about the food I cook. And yet, of course, everyone has, you know, we'll have to, in some sense, find a way to make those recipes work for them. I always think it's a miracle that anyone can write a recipe that someone else likes, because our tastes are so profound and personal. And yet I'm very happy to say, because of the response I get to my recipes, is that these recipes do translate, and people do find a way of just responding, and recipes find their way into other people's homes. And I think that is the great joy of writing recipes, that it's on one hand, when you write a book, you know, you're in your room and you're writing it, and people then find it later in a bookstore or online and they get it. But then if those recipes work, they're such a peculiarly intimate form of communication, because you're suddenly becoming part of people's lives in an everyday way. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I'm sort of overwhelmed by it, but I enjoy it as well when I read other people's books and I cook their food, and especially if it comes from some part of their life and it's a story of how that recipe came to be. I think it's a wonderful way of being part of a community, and perhaps that's very, very important now, as you said earlier. I think we all need to belong in some way, and that belonging can take different forms. But it's a bit like, you know, one always feels very, I think, one always feels a particular bond with people who enjoy reading the same novels. And you can read, and there's something wonderful about book recommendations. And the same way it's with food. You do feel a particular bond if someone makes the same cake or makes the same chicken recipe, and you talk about it and why you like it. And that's those are important. I think that in a way, I think in the modern world, people are so seem to find a community and that they share hatred for things. So how wonderful to celebrate sharing an enthusiasm for something.
Well, my example of that is that my partner frequently makes brownies, and she swears by them, and they're from How to Be a Domestic Goddess, and she's now passed on that recipe because everybody wants to know how she made those brownies. She's now passed that recipe on.
Oh, that's lovely.
That's such a
lovely thing, and it never becomes anything other than a joy and just a delight, actually, a delight.
There was one aspect of recipe making that I'd never have thought about that you touched on in the book. You talk about the anxiety you get figuring out how many people to cook for.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering, how do you come up with the number of how many people a recipe serves?
It's some recipes are simple, obviously, like, you know, you've got two pork chops, you know, going to serve two. But it's so hard because, as I say in the book, you know, what size your plates are, what have you eaten, you know, what else have you eaten that day. I mean, I always try and make generous portions. So because I cook everything at home and I eat it a lot, I tend to think, because whenever I have people over, I'm so terrified of running out of food, I always make enough. So I always will base my serving recommendations on what I would do. I try and give a range, like 6 to 8, so you know that, yes, 6 is going to have a lot, and 8 you'll still have enough, but there won't be as much, or whatever it is. But you could go on forever worrying, you know, that it is one of those things that I would always live in fear of not having enough food. The idea that but then the same way when I write a recipe, I want to be very careful that I don't want people to have to waste too much. Not that, you know, it is a difficult one. But as I say, I err towards generosity. But I sometimes will add a note in the margin that, you know, that this will be the right amount. But if you were going to have maybe two side dishes, it would stretch to more, or if you cut the meat differently, it will stretch to more. So I sort of think you have to try as much as possible to explain, you know, my reasoning when I think it needs to be explained. But it's something that I've found that most food writers worry about, actually.
I love that line. I always err on the side of generosity. I feel like that could be a maxim for life. We're about out of time, but I want to I'd be remiss. This is the food show. If I didn't have you tell me at least one recipe that you're really excited about from this book.
The recipe that I cook an awful lot from it. Is a chicken and pea tray bake, which is like a sheet pan dinner, but I actually go and put frozen peas straight into the sheet pan with some chicken thighs and some dill and some leeks, olive oil, garlic, and it really is, that's fantastic. But since we're now just about coming into strawberry season, I feel, and I've started this a summer of making a wonderful pavlova with some ground pepper and rose water in the meringue base, and some passion fruit juice in with the strawberries. And I have to say that for me it is the scent of the summer.
Nigella, that sounds delicious. Before I let you go, I just want to know what's getting you excited right now? What's fueling you?
What's fueling me? Well, the prospect of some blue skies ahead and sitting outside with some rosé wine and you know, at tables loaded with food. That's what's exciting me right now. I don't know whether I should have a loftier source of joy ahead, but to me, eating well, drinking well, and in good company seems to me a pretty good plan to have for the future.
That sounds wonderful. Simple pleasures. Nigella, thank you so much for talking with me on the food show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
That was Nigella Lawson, author of the new cookbook, At My Table, A Celebration of Home Cooking. You're listening to The Food Show. In a moment, we'll have our monthly garden segment with Marisha Auerbach. Stay with us. You're listening to The Food Show. I'm Chris Siegel. We experienced a bit of a heat wave this past weekend. I took my first trip to the river and saw that in my home garden, my small starts shot up. This is the time of year when plants grow fast, and it's important to get organized. I'm joined by Marisha Auerbach for our monthly garden segment. She's going to help us stay on top of all the garden tasks. Marisha, welcome back to The Food Show.
Thanks, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
So before we get to those aforementioned garden tasks, what's getting you excited about the garden these days?
Oh, the garden is so lovely right now. There's so many flowers in bloom. I'm really loving the bearded irises and the poppies and the smell of sweet rocket on the air in the evening. I've been finishing up with some of the things that have overwintered with water, with eating them and getting into eating the spring garden.
So I want to talk about that. I know it's the, you know, still kind of the beginning of the season, but I love leading with eating. So I haven't been super on top of things this year, but I did recently have my first round of radishes, and they were so good. So I'm wondering, what are some of the things that you're eating from the garden right now?
I also just ate my first radishes this week. I call these days the salad days of summer because the salads have really started kicking in and there's tons of lettuces. I'm enjoying having my eggs and greens that I make every morning wrapped up inside a big lettuce leaf. I just ate the first peas. I'm finishing up on the chard that's been in the ground over winter and tossing the ones that are going that are starting to bolt. I'm tossing them over to the chickens so they can enjoy them.
Nice. We are gonna, I think, have a spinach salad tonight. That's a big one. I like that, the salad days of the garden. So I want to jump into as I mentioned, there's been some hot weather. In April, I promised that we'd come back to the topic of hot weather crops. So here we are. As I've walked around town, I've seen tomatoes all over the place in the ground. And so I'm wondering, is it time to plant our tomatoes, our melons, peppers, all the crops that thrive in hot weather?
Well, we've got two thresholds that we're looking at when we say all of the crops that thrive in hot weather. There's the things that enjoy 50 degrees minimum nighttime temperature, and we've reached that threshold. We are solidly in that space. But we haven't yet had an evening that's 60 degrees minimum nighttime temperature. So at 60 degrees, that's when it's time to get in our peppers and our melons and eggplant and basil. So those, it's still a little too early, and I'm pretty sure that we'll be able to get all of those crops in by the end of the month. So that's our basil and our peppers and our eggplant and our melons. But the 50-degree evening temperature is the time where we can get in our tomatoes, and we reached that about 2 weeks ago, and it's been solidly 50 degrees or above. So 50 degrees, things at like 50-degree average nighttime temperature are tomatoes, cucumbers, squash, yeah.
Great. So if you've got your tomatoes in the ground at this point, good on you. If not, now's the time.
Yeah, that's right. And if you've got your peppers and your eggplants and your basil in the ground, you might want to give them a blanket at night. It's about between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. that it gets too cold, and that's when these plants can get stunted, or you might not necessarily have the harvest that you would expect off of them. Maybe you get less eggplants, which is always something that tends to happen for us. It's not very common for our nighttime temperatures to stay above 60 for a long time. So, you know, that's why we always need to go with the more hardy varieties of eggplants and peppers, because we do tend to have cooler evenings than much of the rest of the country, being more influenced by the maritime, the ocean nearby, rather than the continental U.S., which holds more heat units at night.
Okay, so for the folks who haven't gotten their tomatoes in, and that's not the last thing, but I'm thinking about the longer season plants, the plants that are going to be in the garden for a while. Is there anything that they should do to help those plants make it into the fall and winter?
Well, the thing I really enjoy doing is just giving it a really good dose of compost, making sure that your compost is well balanced, that you have well-drained soil, that your soil is mulched so that your soil is very water retentive. And when I think of things that are going to go from the fall into the winter, many of those I plant later in the summer. There are some root crops that you can get really huge if you plant them right now, but we also have some time to get them in the ground before we're planting for the winter garden.
And do you use any soil amendments? I don't know if adding nitrogen for tomatoes works, or is it, do you think compost
When I plant my tomatoes, I'll put a scoop of organic fertilizer in the hole and a scoop of bone meal. Because we tend to have acidic soils, calcium is a issue. We don't always have enough calcium available in our soils. So bone meal is a good way to get calcium in your soil. You can also use gypsum or ground up oyster shells. Bone meal is just more potent and available at the right time. I like the Complete Organic Fertilizer from Concentrates, although I know that Naomi's has some nice alternatives too. And I like to plant my tomatoes deep so that their stem becomes the roots and leaving just like about two or three sets of leaves above the ground. You also want to take off the bottom leaves off your tomatoes. As they grow, you actually take off all the leaves up to the first flowering cluster. And that's so that when you water, the water doesn't splash on the leaves because that can cause fungal diseases for tomatoes. Having enough calcium also makes them more resistant against fungal diseases and the dreaded blossom end rot.
And I'm sure as we go throughout the season, we'll have more things to say about maintaining those long season plans. But as we're still getting them into the ground, we talked about this a little bit last month, but what's the best way to harden off the vegetables, the starts that we have, getting them ready to live outside in the garden?
Well, if you have starts inside your home, you want to bring them outside during the day and then bring them in at night for the first 2 days. And then after that, you'll have two more days where you bring them outside and leave them outside for the full day. And then on the fifth day, once your plants have spent 2 days outside in the evenings getting adjusted, then you can put them in the ground.
All right. So leaving those hot weather crops, what else can we be putting in the ground right now? Like, I'm wondering, is it too late for peas?
I don't think it's too late for peas. I don't think it's even too late for potatoes. You're just going to harvest them a lot later. You can be putting in beets or beans. Beans are another one of those crops I should mention that likes that 50 degrees in the evening threshold. We could put in carrots and beets. And it's a little late for the brassicas, although Brussels sprouts is best to go in right now. And when you're putting in any of the brassicas, you want to make sure they have a cool microclimate where they don't get that hot western sun. Save the western sun for your warm season vegetables.
And speaking of sun, I'm thinking about how dry the garden can get, especially here in the summer. What are some practical ways that we can make sure that our plants stay watered?
Well, adding compost is one of the best ways to do it because compost acts like a sponge, and so it holds water and enhances your water-holding capacity while also providing nutrients. Cliff Mass, who's a meteorologist up in Washington, just wrote a really great blog post about the decrease in moisture in our soil that happens in the month of May. So I encourage people who are interested in thinking about this, how we can maintain water in our soil, to go and check out his blog. But so keeping lots of compost in your soil, you can also provide that organic matter through well-composted manure. And then it's nice to have mulch on your garden or have a living mulch where you have companion planting going so that you reduce the amount of transpiration that happens from the soil. It's also a good idea to water early in the morning when the plants are most receptive to being able to take in that water, which I like to water around 8 a.m., 7 a.m. is really nice because then they have about 4 hours before the sun crests high noon when their stomata close and they're less receptive to water. When we water in the evening in this climate, our plants are more susceptible to fungal disease, as that's when fungal disease tends to spread, is in the evening. So it's good to water in the morning so that everything's dried up by evening.
So I want to, we're going to be talking, or we're going to be featuring an interview with Eric Tonesmeyer at the end of the program, but you're actually working with Eric on a revised version of his book, Perennial Vegetables. How's that coming along?
It's coming along really good. We have a database of about 600 perennial vegetables that are cultivated by cultures all over the world. And his first book focused mostly on things that we can cultivate in the United States. But now we're looking all over the world and we're highlighting things for tropical climates and temperate climates and dryland climates. And it's really fascinating to look at these different patterns throughout the crops and see what people are eating. And there's some things that are really surprising, and there's others that are, you know, pretty common. And we're also going to be having a nutritional analysis available in that book because it turns out that perennial vegetables being in the ground and having a more adapted root system are actually more nutritious than our annual vegetables.
And what are some of the perennial vegetables that work really well for our climate?
Well, I love lovage. That's one of my favorites. I like to make a risotto in the spring with lovage and French sorrel, which is another amazing perennial vegetable. Lots of people grow asparagus. It's probably one of the most common perennial vegetables for our climate. But asparagus is actually better for alkaline soils and places that don't get as much water in the winter. So gardeners in our climate that are growing asparagus need to do a bit of adapting to be able to make it nice for them. I have two different kinds of perennial onions, the Egyptian walking onion, which is a top-setting onion, as well as the perennial Welsh onion. Those are both delightful. When you get into tubers, Jerusalem artichokes or oca or mashua. Mashua is a perennial nasturtium that produces a tuber. And yacón. Mashua, yacón, and oca are all perennial tubers from Peru. So there's so many different types of perennial vegetables, and I've been collecting them, and I have a lot of them available in my nursery right now.
So we also have coming up the Village Building Convergence, and you've been involved with that in the past. Can you tell us a little bit about that event?
Yeah, the Village Building Convergence is 10 days of natural building and permaculture in Portland. And there's sites all over the city that are hosting community events where you can get together and build with your neighbors and be able to create a public gathering space to enhance connection in our neighborhoods. The Village Building Convergence has been going on for, I think it's over 15 years or so. It's at least been that, I think, since I first started going. And it's a great way to connect with other people in Portland and have a hands-on opportunity to enhance our space. In the evenings, there's also a community dinner, and then there's speakers, and sometimes there's music as well. This year, there's not going to be a single venue for every night. It's going to bounce around the city, giving opportunities to people no matter what quadrant you live in. And I know that on Saturday, June 2nd, I'll be on a panel on women in permaculture with my good friend Monica Ibacachi from New York City.
Wonderful. And before I let you go, what other classes or sales do you have coming up?
Well, my next workshop on what to do now in the garden for June is on Tuesday, June 5th at People's Food Co-op, and we're going to be talking about maintenance and harvest as well as pests and diseases. My next plant sale is scheduled for Saturday, May 26th from 10 a.m. to 2. The nursery is also open by appointment. And for people who might be interested in taking a permaculture design course, I know enrollment is open now for the permaculture design course that I teach at Portland Community College, Rock Creek Campus.
Great. Marisha, thank you so much for coming on and bestowing your garden wisdom upon us.
Thanks for having me.
That was permaculturist Marisha Auerbach. And you're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. In a moment, I'll have an interview with Eric Tonesmeyer, author of The Carbon Farming Solution. Stay with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Food Show. I'm Chris Siegel. Climate politics are grim. In a world where some of our leaders are denying the impact of climate change, it is more important than ever to talk about it. Not only that, but it's important to talk about proactive solutions. In his book, The Carbon Farming Solution, a global toolkit of perennial crops and regenerative agriculture practices for climate change mitigation and food security, Eric Tonesmeyer talks about the systems he's seen around the world that can give us the tools to push back against the effects of climate change. The interview with Eric Tonesmeyer first aired on The Food Show in September of 2016. So this book is essentially a solution to a problem, and I want to start with the problem. From production, transportation, processing, etc., the food industry is massive and has serious impacts on the environment. Could you tell us what are some of the negative impacts on global climate that are attributed to agriculture?
Sure. Well, in terms of overall emissions, human emissions, anthropogenic emissions, agriculture and the clearing of land for agriculture, cutting down a forest for new agricultural land, are responsible for about a quarter of all human emissions. Now, that's a lot. On the other hand, food production is a pretty central human activity, so it makes sense that that would be a place where we would have to really put some attention. And it's not, many people think we can greatly reduce those emissions and also sequester a huge amount of carbon in agriculture, making it actually a force for an overall force for climate change mitigation, a force for good.
I feel like we need to give the listeners an explanation of what carbon farming is. Could you tell us what exactly it means?
Absolutely. It's a suite of practices, and there's lots and lots of them, lots of different kinds. And then, you know, there's about 40 basic types, and then each of those has 1,000 sort of local interpretations of them. And the thing that they have in common is that they remove excess carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and they store it either in organic matter in the soil or in perennial vegetation. And the way it works, people vaguely remember back to high school biology, is when plants do photosynthesis, that's how they get their energy from the sun and whatnot, part of the process is that they take carbon dioxide and they break the carbon off. So they release the oxygen for us to breathe, thank you very much. And that carbon they make into sugars and fibers and other kinds of compounds in their tissues. So that's where it happens, is it happens through photosynthesis. And then over time, it either becomes part of their, you know, the woody parts of a tree, for example, or organic matter in the soil.
So then the idea is that the longer or the more that we can keep the plant in the soil, the better job it's going to do in sequestering the carbon, right? If you harvest the plant or take out the whole plant, then that carbon's going back into the atmosphere.
Generally speaking, although let's say if you cut down a tree and build a house with it, then that carbon that was in that trunk is going to be there for a nice long time, could be there for a century or something in a house. So that's another kind of sequestration in long-lived products.
And you've done a lot of work in the world of permaculture. How much does carbon farming draw from permaculture practices?
Well, it was certainly my entry point into carbon farming. I've been looking at the pieces of permaculture that have been interesting to me are about perennial crops and the food forest. And I've really, in the course of writing this book, come to understand that permaculture didn't invent any of the things I like about permaculture. And many of them have actually been done for thousands of years around the world, especially in the tropics. These are long-standing practices, and many of them are still practiced on a very, very wide scale. Today, I had no idea how tiny permaculture's drop in the bucket really is when it comes to things like agroforestry, which is integrating trees and farms. There's maybe a third or more of the world's cropland is already practicing agroforestry, but again, that's mostly in the tropics, so it doesn't get as much airtime as some of the other kind of things that people are doing. But permaculture is how I got here, and all of the carbon farming practices are certainly tools that can be used in a system that uses permaculture design, absolutely, and should be. And absolutely should be.
I want to jump into some of those tools that you're talking about, the tools of carbon farming. What are some tools or practices that you learn from other places around the world?
Sure. Well, one of the ones that was really fascinating that I had never heard of is called the System of Rice Intensification. And it's a system for small rice growers, for like a smallholder, small farmer rice producer. First of all, rice production in rice paddies is a major source of methane, which is a huge greenhouse gas. So one thing that that system of rice intensification does is it greatly reduces the amount of time there's flooding, so it reduces methane emissions. And it's not anything really fancy. It's about spacing the plants a little more widely and transplanting them when they're a different age and a few other kind of cultural practices like that. There's some composting that goes on, but it can greatly increase the yields, like double or triple the production of rice in the same area. It does involve more labor. That's why it's limited to smaller farms. And there's somewhere around 10 million people doing this around the world, 10 million farms, which makes it bigger than organic annual crop production. So it's a more widely practiced than organic when it comes to annual crop farming, but I had never heard of it. That's crazy to me. It's because it's mostly done by small farmers in Asia, and they're not on Facebook or whatever sending stuff around about what they do in the same way, or they're not doing it in the language that I was in contact with previously. So that's a great one that, you know, increases production, reduces emissions, and sequesters carbon. That's wonderful. That's marvelous.
So you've mentioned agroforestry, and I wanna kind of get some more details. Can you describe agroforestry and the role it plays in carbon farming?
Sure. So agroforestry is any kind of farming that integrates trees. So it might be in an annual crop farm, you might just be putting in windbreaks or hedgerows, or you might be in the tropics. Often you're integrating nitrogen-fixing trees that provide fertility to your crops. You might be intercropping with timber trees or fruit trees or nut trees. And when the spacing is done properly and the right species are selected, you can actually increase production of the annual crops plus gain products or benefits from the trees. And you typically are increasing the levels of carbon overall something like 5 to 10 times more than the best annual cropping practices alone. So a big bonus from agroforestry in terms of carbon. Likewise, a pasture can have trees added to it, not at a forest type density, but more widely spaced. And again, we're looking at 5 or 10 times more carbon per acre per year in those kind of systems. So if carbon is what we want, trees are what we want to do it. They not only have carbon in their woody parts above ground, but also they make a big difference underground. Just all those leaves falling down, it's marvelous mulch and compost and stuff. And then we have the fully perennial systems with multiple layers of trees and shrubs or herbs, or we're hoping to see perennial grain systems coming in. We're very close on a bunch of those. And those have the fully perennial multi-story food forest type systems have the most carbon of any kind of farming. There is the perennial grains will have much less, but they produce things we know and love and that we already have a food system built around. So it's not that there's any one that's right or wrong overall. It's really which one is the right one for this farm in the landscape or this place in the watershed with these markets and with these goals for that farmer. I'm not trying to tell people what to do. I'm trying to give them a set of tools they can use to decide what to do at the farm level, at the, you know, community level or landscape level, and ideally at the national and international level as well.
Is there a place where you saw agroforestry especially well implemented?
Yes, I think the best place in the world, certainly the best place I've ever been, is a place called Las Cañadas in Mexico. They're in the mountains near Yucatan, and boy, really, you can see all this stuff on display there, and they not only have every kind of practice you can imagine, but they keep meticulous records on everything. So they can tell you the budget, they can tell you how many hours of labor, they can tell you all the inputs, they can tell you the yields, they can tell you how the phosphorus is moving around in there and everything. So that kind of excellent demonstration, working demonstration, that people are actually making money on and making their getting their food from and stuff, and also the attention to detail is just marvelous. And part of why they can do that is there's very few regulations there to keep people from doing things like having a 12 acre, or I guess it's a maybe 15 acres of corn and beans that's fertilized with composted human manure. Well, you're not going to get away with that here so easily. So there is a freedom that they have being in Mexico that enables them to be at the leading edge on a lot of these practices. But mostly it's because they're just absolute visionaries and incredibly hardworking folks.
I'm wondering, what is holding back carbon farming from being fully implemented?
Well, so many things. First, none of these practices were actually developed for their carbon impact. They were all developed because they're good for the farm or they're good for the environment in some other way, mostly because they increase productivity on the farm, or they reduce erosion, which in the long term is good for productivity on the farm. So the barriers are many. First of all, like in the U.S., we have a system of subsidies that supports unsustainable agriculture. Sort of our whole global food system really supports unsustainable agriculture, and so we need to be, there's a bunch of shifts that need to happen at that level to make some of this happen, and certainly the financing and some of the access to education and training is pretty key. I think partly what it's going to take is a global recognition that first of all, climate change